South African affiliate of the International Association of Impact Assessment. I've got Steve Stead here on my left supporting me, and this is our contribution. Our contribution is based on the background that South Africa has responded to the need for social and economic, dealing with the social and economic challenges in the country as presented in the National Development Plan by proposals for significant infrastructure development that will take place over the next couple of years. And that infrastructure development may have a significant impact on the environment. It's therefore important and a challenge to us to take on our responsibility as the sector, and I speak about all the people in this room, both environmental assessment practitioners, government, academics, all the sectors involved in the environment who contribute constructively towards these processes. IAISA is a voluntary association, and we have approximately 1,000 members, a number of which are in the venue this afternoon. And our members are mostly environmental assessment practitioners, but also specialists, industry, government, and academia. We believe that mechanisms need to be put in place in an EIA, effectively identify significant issues, to assess them comprehensively, and therefore to provide to governments who are the decision-making authorities with the information that they need to make those correct decisions. EIAs have been around in the country for a while, but it's actually not a very old profession, and I think we've come to a point now where we've had opportunity to learn from the years that we've been in practice, and based on that, we have to make the following recommendations going forward. First of all, we believe that it's an absolute priority that the registration authority, at this stage, IPASA being on the table, be recognised in terms of the Act by the Minister, and that this will deal with the issues of ethical standards and competency that we've been hearing over the last two days here in this meeting. Secondly, we propose that once a registration authority is a requirement, that we will no longer need to have a requirement of independence in our legislation. We believe that independence is in the legislation in an attempt to deal with the issue of having practitioners that are competent and practicing ethically, and that if IPASA plays that role, we no longer need that requirement. Also believe that independence at the moment is actually militating against the involvement of people in a process from early on that can add constructively to a best environmental option. Thirdly, we like to propose that in South Africa we should have one EIA regime for all sectors, specifically recognising that mining is a sector that, while it contributes significantly economically and socially to the country, it also has the potential for significant impacts on the environment. And we believe that mining should fall fully under the National Environmental Management Act, as do other activities. And then, until this is in place, the quality and standard of our EIAs are in jeopardy. We've heard over the last 2 days of the initiatives towards integrated authorizations, and we cannot support that enough. When we, as practitioners, are trying to get our clients to comply with the legal requirements for their proposed developments, at the moment we have to apply for a multitude of authorizations and licenses, many of which have similar processes, and it becomes a very complicated, costly, and takes a lot of time. In terms of independent review, We would like to propose that although the regulations already make provision for the use of independent review, not in a compulsory manner but as and when required, that this facility could be used by the department to address some of the issues that were raised earlier. The recommendation was that the department appoint their own EAP to do a parallel EIA, and we propose that that would not be a very good idea for a number of reasons, and that an alternative way to deal with that would be to use independent reviewers. This is done in a number of other countries where you have a panel of reviewers that the department has access to, and either one reviewer for a small project or incorporating specialists as required, depending on the project on the table, should be involved from the onset of the EIA process to perform that function. Furthermore, we support wholeheartedly the norms and standards, development of guidelines, and also propose that perhaps increasing the role of screening in the EIA process will be able to streamline the process, make it cost-effective and quick enough so that the process doesn't get sidelined and we can actually achieve the objective of protecting the environment. One component that is missing in our EIA regime at the moment is that of follow-up. By this I mean that we don't have a mechanism at the moment to check if an EIA has been done after the case, whether those impacts that were predicted did actually occur and whether the mitigation that was proposed was effective or not. So as a result, us EAPs are applying the same methodology to our EIAs over and over again, and we're never receiving feedback whether that methodology is actually effective enough. So we believe that we need to have some mechanism to close that loop, and after the project is developed, to see whether what we believe would be the impact, in fact, was the impact or not, so that we can amend our methodology to be more accurate and appropriate. Compliance monitoring and reporting. Compliance monitoring and reporting has been raised by other speakers in this meeting, and we believe that it is also an area that is not very strong in South Africa at the moment, and we support initiatives to strengthen that. Many of the recommendations that we made when we were working by ourselves have actually been echoed by other speakers in this forum, which is quite encouraging because it shows us that there is synergy, and another of those is the use of strategic tools. And the fact that EIA is not a planning tool. EIA is only to assess the impact of a specific project. And in the lack of other strategic and planning instruments being in place over the last 10, 20 years, we've been forced to use EIA to make decisions that should have been made by other tools. Therefore, we fully support the implementation of environmental management frameworks and strategic environmental assessments and other tools that can provide us with a framework within which to do an EIA. One of the problems that our members have expressed to us is a lack of consistency between the provinces in the way that EIA regulations are implemented, also in the level of the capacity of the officials that they have, and this is something that could possibly be looked at and addressed. At the moment, the EIA regime has a lot of procedures which leads to a tick box approach. And we believe that we need to guard against just having more rules and regulations and procedures and things in place, but that what we actually need to do is have an increase in flexibility in the process and increase the quality of the environmental assessments that are done. Did not include it in my written submission, but while I was sitting here the last day, Advocate Longa, I was asking myself the question, I thought the question you would ask me is, well, how can AIASA as an organisation contribute to where we want to go forward. And so I'd just like to share with the House that one of the activity that we provide to our members is continued professional development, which is in the form of giving courses, conferences, branch meetings, networking, providing information. And we hope that we can work with government to reach consultants that are practicing as environmental assessment practitioners and specialists and undertaking public participation to raise the standard of the work that results in the reports that the departments end up with on their table. In this vein, we are hoping that in the future, once IPASA is registered, that our AIA might be able to get delegated authority to be a CPD accreditation authority, and we have planned in progress. Obviously, there would have to be a process by which that became legal, but that is the kind of role that we could play in the future to contribute towards a more efficient EIA regime in the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much. A lot of issues raised. The one that struck me was you want to remove the independence.
Yes.
Because you want to make the EAPs part of the project process.
No. South Africa, as far as I know, is the only country in the world that has independence as a requirement for an environmental assessment practitioner. And we believe that the requirement should be that you are professional and ethical and competent, and that independence is a substitute for that which is not achieving that at the moment. The way to achieve that is through IPASA. And independence at the moment has been almost over-implemented.
But how can it be over-implemented?
Now, let me explain to you.
I mean, every single person that comes here tells us that not a single EIP person is independent. So how can it be over?
At the moment,
I understand that you don't want it. Well, I don't understand why you don't want it, but I can understand why you're saying it, but I don't have a clue what that will mean, because if you take away some legal obligation of impartiality, if you take that away, even if it is a myth, then the problem is you become part, then the consequence of that is that you basically become part of the project planning. And you're just an employee that wants to make sure that the project gets whatever it gets, it gets going. The only thing that divorces that from it is this requirement that it is independent. I just do not fully understand what you guys are trying to suggest.
If I respond, I think the issue of the independence would be essentially taken away by the implementation of a registration authority, because through that process, you'd have a lot more accountability of the EIPs, and I think that is the issue that is really at stake. The independence is related to how do you ensure this accountability takes place.
And I understand what you're saying. There's an institution that's created, and that institution will hold you accountable. But that does not create a legal obligation for you to apply your mind independently of your project.
But that will be one of the, as it is for our AIA, it's one of our code of ethics that our members sign. It will similarly be a code of ethics.
Why would I want you to sign a code of ethics if it should be rather a legal obligation? Why would I want you to sign something privately with other people that you'll be independent
The independence is creating a problem at the moment that's not...
What problem is it creating? The only problem it's creating, everyone comes and tells us except you, the only problem it creates is that you're not independent. I mean, that's what everyone comes and tells us. So
I don't think that's a real problem. I think the real problem is...
Everyone else is wrong. Only the association is right. Okay. Now, that's a novel.
I think
the
problem...
Chief, you know I don't like the TVs in front here. People get distracted and they start grandstanding. Okay. No, that's fine. Kiss it from the side. They look much better from the side, please. I don't like it when the TVs are here. I've never in my committees allowed TVs to be here because the TV is a distraction to people. So you see, I mean, I don't care if you hit me on the side. It's actually the best part of me. Now, please, the TV must be at the back there, out of the way. Here for information, not distraction. Thank you very much.
We do agree that environmental assessment practitioners need to they are looking at the interests of the environment, protection of the environment and sustainable development. But the mechanism to make sure that is done should be through our certification, the same as a group, all other professions.
But certification is a qualification. Do you comply with certain qualifications? Yes. If you do something wrong, we'll discipline you. That's what it is. That's what the organization does. It doesn't create a legal obligation for you to apply your mind independently. Now, the legal obligation you may say is a myth, is not a myth, who knows, but at least it's a legal obligation. If you then want to discipline someone and someone then says, but there's no obligation on me to be independent. The law doesn't say I must be independent, it says I must comply with these criteria to be a member of this organization. So I'm not understanding what you're trying to say. In the end of the day, I mean, it's just like judges. People say, people are interfering with judges because they complain. For me, I never have seen independence like that from a judge. A judge's independence is in his head or her head. A judge is going to be, if they are acting intellectually with integrity, then they're going to act by using their intellect and being independent. There's nothing you can do, there's no amount of institutions you can create to make it. If a judge wants to be rule in favor of government or in favor of big business or something, that'll be is because in their head they're not independent of looking at the facts. So independence is not an institutional arrangement that you make. The institutional arrangement may support to some extent the independence, but the independence is in the head. Whether I'm going to think like if I'm going to sit here with a rubber stamp, an ANC rubber stamp, and only ANC decisions that have been taken rubber stamp it, then I can do that and it will look independent. But the real independence is my head. Whether I act independently in terms of facts placed before me, I look at something and I make a decision. So I think you guys must re-look this issue. I think you've been on the wrong track. The institution can only support, it cannot create that independence and the kind of things we want to do. What we want is practitioners that can act with integrity in terms of the environment whilst earning a living. Do you know that that's the most difficult thing in the world to do? Very few people get it right.
But how come it's no other country in the world that has the requirement for independence? How did that
happen? I don't know if it's true, but if it is like that, then I think it's the other countries are wrong. If there's no legal requirement of independence, it's crazy.
I might just make a comment to that. The independence is an issue, but you actually sign a report saying that you're independent is not necessarily going to result in independence. The professional standards...
It's not going to result in independence, but what it does do, it creates a legal obligation that I can discipline you if you are not... Otherwise, I can't do it. Because I've not created a legal obligation for you to be independent. You say, no, my boss and the person that pays me is that person there. And you have not in law required me to be independent from that. So I think we need to look at that thing. I mean, as I say, talking doesn't create independence. It's with the people that have the right skill base, that have the right environment, that have the right way of using their heads and thinking independently and making independent decisions that fit into that legal framework. But by taking away the word independent because the rest of the world has done so, is just a complete knee-jerk reaction.
That's not the reason to do it.
Well, that's the reason you've given. Your whole argument is based on the fact that why do we do it? Because the rest of the world doesn't. Well, there's a lot of things that we've done that the rest of the world hasn't done. A lot of them. And this is one of them. We should really try and... But look, we've said enough. Let me, Mr. Court.
I think when we do benchmarking with other countries in EIA, we must do it within the full context. We are also, if not the only country, one of the few countries that have an independent environmental decision as a result of an EIA process. It is an authorization in its own right. The international practice in this regard is that the EIA makes input into a line function decision. So there isn't a separate environmental authorization, which is linked to the way that we approach it differently, because it's a separate permitting process than what is the international practice in terms of EIAs.
Okay, well, that's another, I don't fully understand what you're saying, but I mean, I know what you're saying, and I'll have to work it out.
If I can add to this, I mean, the particular complaint we're getting from our members at the moment is the latest implementation of that clause in the regulation that says if a consultancy has EAPS that undertake the EIA and specialists in the same company, that consultancy specialists may not work on the EIA that the EAP is undertaking. So it's going...
Well, wouldn't you want that to stay like that? I would want to. But you won't, because you're making money out of it. But the rest of us, we don't have that much faith in you, man.
Yeah.
Not in you personally, but I'm in your profession. I mean, like any other profession, I'll feel exactly the same about lawyers. I'll feel exactly the same about doctors. People that regulate themselves and look after their own interests are not the best custodians of values and integrity. So, I mean, exactly the example you've given, like, shoot you completely out of the water. You've just bombed yourself. You threw a bomb right in your own hedge. Because you now want the same people that are actually doing the one task also to do this, and the same people in the same company to be able to be part of it. Wow. Yow. I think we can't work. Can I just say to the world, we can't get a prasa quick enough. If this is how these members feel, we can't get a prasa quick enough. Can I just say that? Okay, questions, comments? I think everyone's so stunned that they... Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Comer and Mr. Steed. Okay, we... back off the two, so we're back on the program again. Is a Mr. Ayling here? Mr. Ayling? Come forward. When you're ready, you have 10 minutes, sir. You from the South African Wind Energy Association. Okay, help me.
Honorary Chair, members, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not Duncan, I'm Mike Magnall. I'm replaced Duncan. I'm presenting the views of the South African Wind Energy Association. To start off with the strengths, the EIA process is clear, structured, and robust. We feel it involves a thorough, inclusive, and transparent process. It ensures that interested and affected parties are informed of potential projects and have adequate opportunity to voice their concerns and or support of those projects. It allows for information to be shared understandably to the various interested and affected parties. It also allows clearly regulated timeframes, and then which allows then for proper planning processes by developers, knowing that an EIA is 12 months long plus minus and roughly a four or five months approval time period. One can then do your feasibility studies accordingly. However, we do have issues around those timelines and them not being adhered to, but I'll speak more about that now. Around the environmental management plan, we think it's a useful document if compiled properly and reviewed properly, and then it acts as a dynamic document which is updated on a regular basis to guide projects through construction and operation and doesn't constrain the project to unrealistic expectations as a result. However, the environmental affairs has an enormous EIA workload, as we all know, particularly around the burst of renewable energy projects that's being put on the table at the moment. in excess of 600 wind and solar applications have been tabled with the DEA, which totals more than 30,000 megawatts, which is a huge number, but it's important to remember that only a fifth, about 20% of those might ever reach construction once they're chosen as preferred bidders by the Department of Energy. A number of EIAs are put forward are speculative. For the long lead EIA timeframes, they force early application and unnecessary application sometimes. Numerous other consents are also required by a wind or solar developer to be BIT compliant as well. Members feel the process is too prescriptive and in many cases too onerous, which results in unnecessary delays and frustrations. Reviews are sometimes inconsistent and often exceed the stipulated timeframes, as mentioned earlier. Quite a lot of slippage on various milestones that one needs to get through in the EIA process. The ease with which stakeholders are carrying larger fuels is also concerning to us. There's no cost involved. It could be done to simply extract compensation or delay the process. In our experience, no participation during the EIA process is actually required by an appellant. You don't actually need to be affected by the project and merely have an interest, and you can actually just use it to stop a development. Appeal timelines are regulated, but in practice are completely open-ended. The 90-day time frame can be reset by simply requesting further information or verification.
Why would people oppose these alternative forms of energy? Are you making out it's like a wholesale opposition to these things? I mean, why would that be? Who's opposing? Which kind of people are opposing?
Well, people that don't want to see wind turbine on the landscape in the future are opposing wind.
So the coal people?
Well, it's different people. There are coal people, but generally on an EIA, it's the neighbors. They're not in my backyard. They don't want to see their career landscape visually disturbed by a number of turbines on the landscape, for example. So different parties. EAs, when authorizations are, amongst other things, conditional.
It's like everyone, you know, my neighbors that object, I want to put a wall up for security, which there's a wall already, I want to keep it the same height, I oppose it because it's going to look ugly. The one there is the one that was built 40 years ago, it's like bacon falling down, I want to put one with that's completely see-through. They oppose it, you know, so people are people, you know. That's what democracy is about. Democracy is a very, very messy thing.
So our EAs are conditional on further compliance with other legislation, such as the Water Act and the Subdivision of Agricultural Land. Other departments who need to be consulted after the EA is issued often impose restrictions that conflict with the EA, resulting in amendments which further stretch the EA's capacity. Quality of reporting, as touched on previously by EAPS and specialists, varies dramatically. In particular, we need to do bird and bat impact assessments and monitoring, and these are often based on misunderstandings of wind farms and related technologies. The current process of EAs allows for little flexibility. It's not practical to specify every detail during the EIA, hence a number of projects have to apply for amendments for minor changes. EAs should approve specific on-site, we say, areas for development, versus specific coordinates in the reports and in the EAs, to allow for some flexibility when the actual turbines are selected only a few months prior to the time of bidding to the Department of Energy. However, to continuing to approve, as you currently are doing, a range or maximum turbine heights, we fully support and say that should continue. Additional resources should be employed within the department to deal specifically with wind and solar farm applications. A body of suitably qualified expertise or advisors should be created within DEA that is capable of scrutinizing the technical content of these EAs, in particular special impact mitigation recommendations. This should limit unworkable recommendations, hopefully, and conditions of approval that appear in the EA, which then should hopefully reduce the need for subsequent clarifications and amendments, which are happening on a very regular basis at the moment. Greater efforts should be made to integrate various permitting processes, and other government departments should be involved at an earlier stage by the DEA in terms of providing inputs into the EIA process. This should hopefully result in a more streamlined process and, again, would avoid unnecessary or conflicting comments from various departments. And then again, would reduce, hopefully, the amendment applications post-authorization. We believe that more emphasis should be placed on the scoping phase of the EIA Scoping responses on the department are currently very standardized, we believe, despite the differences in the receiving environment, our project site, and the actual projects themselves. So to scope or screen out areas of high impact earlier would be very useful. It should result in improved and more streamlined process. Reporting and reviewing of these reports should be more consistent and better quality as a result. Efforts could be focused on more sensitive sites and projects, we feel, as a result of this, and this would hopefully save significant resources and time for all parties involved. Where project impacts are likely to be low, then instead of a full EIA or basic assessment, implementation of a EMP and appointment of an environmental control officer should only be requested or should only be necessary. Where a non-substantive...
You've got 2 minutes left.
Thank you. A non-substantive amendment, either one of those are required, we feel that a direct application should be allowed by the developer themselves, which should save time and cost as well. So extreme caution should be taken on...
Direct applications as opposed to?
Needing to go to EIP. So as a developer, you should be allowed to apply to make a non-substantive application where it's just merely paperwork. So in terms of the strategic environmental assessment currently underway for the renewable energy development zones, this extreme caution should be taken for those reasons listed there. I'm not going to list them all, but we believe a lot more work is needed to make that a sound and thorough process, and maybe a better process is suitable. So in terms of the way forward, increasing...
Well, why should there be caution?
Let me go
through... Not understanding your argument?
Yes, sure. I was just running out of time, so...
Okay, I understand.
Great. So we believe that the wind and solar industry, wind in particular, the industry is well advanced. We've been doing this, our detailed studies on numerous parts of the country since 2008. We don't now need to rehash that and get consultants to...
The question was, why should we approach zones with caution, renewable energy zones? This is an area where we think you can do it, and this will be the requirement.
Well, I'm hoping I'm going to...
What is the caution there? I mean, what is the problem?
The caution is now coming up with these zones. Maybe those zones are not the correct zones. Because a lot of work, the 5 years that we've now taken just to get to where we feel areas are, work in terms of technical requirements, proper wind conditions, grids, and environmental conditions. Now to take steps back and go, okay, well, here are actually the best zones. We believe some of the criteria and assumptions used at the moment by the consultants are not accurate, and the appropriateness of major exclusion criteria are not correct. But work is being done on this, let me just say. So it's an ongoing process, but we're just cautioning. This runs the risk of impeding the consent process for applicants outside those zones. A lot of developers are in strange places, and if you now say you're outside and therefore going to be disadvantaged as a result, that would be anti-competitive. Wind farm site selection is...
No, it won't be anti-competitive.
Excuse me?
It won't be anti-competitive. Go to court then. You know, what it's going to be, it's going to tell you where you're allowed to do it and where you're going to have the least impact on the environment. That's what a zone does. Just like any other zone that we agree to. That in terms of, well, you can do this here, but you can't do that here. Anyway, look, your point is a bad point. Just leave it. It's fine. Go on to the next one.
Right. Last slide. So we're suggesting more collaboration be facilitated with the Wind Energy Association, Environmental Affairs, and the EIPs with regards to understanding and promoting environmentally responsible development. Improved integration, as I said earlier, is essential to between various departments to make the process more efficient, consistent, and result in better effective decision-making. Everyone needs to understand how they fit into this process, because there's a lot of conflicting opinions and correspondence that's going around at the moment. Clear platform allowing for follow-up on progress of EIAs and appeals within the DA should be established. I know there's talk about that, but at the moment, the developer quite often feels it goes into a black hole and you don't know where or what is happening. And hopefully this will ultimately lead to a more efficient, interactive, and clearly scheduled process. Thank you.
Ms. McCourt, why are you guys so terrible? Why are you doing these things so badly? And you've asked us to make sure that you're going to do the energy renewal and that every province doesn't do it to fragment the system. So why are you guys so bad?
Chair, I think we need to provide the fact here. There have been delays on some appeals because on the right there's also a person on the other side of that appeal process. And the minister has to make a decision in terms of that process. We've actually, in most instances on wind and solar, exceeded the time frames because we were supporting the applicants in meeting the different bidding windows that was opened by the Department of Energy on specific occasions. So we have processed most of the wind and solar applications faster than the legislature, and this can be demonstrated factually. It has been reported to Cabinet and Parliament in terms of the turnaround times on the wind and the solar.
Well, that's why I'm asking you the question, because previously we had different reports from you. You told us you did these things and that there were some delays, but that on the whole, that's why we should be giving the power at the national level, not to the provinces. So you don't agree with this input?
Gee, there has been some delays, but I think on appeal. But overall, in terms of, it was a whole lot of applications which we fast-tracked in terms of the turnaround times that were halved. And Mr. Abada has reported on this on numerous occasions in terms of the actual factual information in terms of the processing of it. I think the other point that is missed in this whole process is that with the strategic environmental assessment and the zones, we're having delisting and exclusions. So if you are within the preferred zone, you have no further limited regulatory requirements on you because the process has been satisfied. If you are outside of it, it is not prohibited, but you have to be motivating why you should be allowed. So then you still have the regulatory requirement outside of your process. So I think there is just an issue in terms of just the contextualizing of the factual information is that of the 600 of which we haven't expected, it wasn't in our forecast. Our forecast is to process 400 applications per year. We've received 600, and the vast majority of that 600 was processed in more expedient than the regulated time frame.
Comments, questions? Any comments or questions? Thank you very much. Thank you, sir. Sorry, there we are. There's something there. Just hang on a minute. May I have to respond?
Yeah, Chair. I mean, just to state that more than 25 gigawatts have been approved already through the environmental process. The real challenge that I think this sector faces is that in terms of the IRP, only 3.8 gigawatts in the first phase are allowed in terms of that policy. So we've got pre-approval, if you want, for 25 gigawatts, but only 3.8 can actually be allocated in legal terms. So there is some work to do in terms of engaging with the Department of Energy in the next phase of or the review of the IRP numbers. That's one point. The second point is that, as we said, through the SEA, there would be zones which would have lower requirements for environmental impact assessment once the strategic environmental assessment. It doesn't prevent anyone from going through the full EIA process outside of that zone. So there's nothing in the zonation which excludes any other site. So I think that the Wind Association needs to take comfort that there's no intent to restrict wind just to this area and you're not allowed to do it anywhere else. The zonation is about lifting the regulatory requirements within particular areas. Thank you.
Any final responses?
Yes, sir.
No, thank you. The South African Property Owners Association. Are you here? Huh? All right. If they do arrive, they're at the back of the queue. They will then go last. They're not there timelessly. The Western Cape Property Development Forum. Are they here? Yes, sir, you can come forward. Mr. Van Sel.
Okay.
Over here at the end, Mr. Van Sel. Thank you. I don't know how long you've been sitting here, Mr. Van Sale, but you basically have 10 minutes. So don't tell me about how wonderful your organization is. Just go to the point you want us to address. No problem. Let's wait till they're on there and we'll punch the clock. Welcome and thank you for availing yourself of this opportunity. You can start when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will work from the assumption that the written document that we've presented has been read by the committee. I would like to highlight specific points that were addressed. I'm not going to deal with the full report. We'll skip point one, taking your points. I would like to reflect on the property industry in general in context of the environmental legislation. We will be advocating a facilitative mindset when it comes to drafting and interpretation of regulations, and we are calling on a interpretation of legislation within current economic, social, and environmental context. And lastly, we would like to speak about the appeals process and the impact on the industry. The slide that you see on the wall at the moment is a slide that I've taken out of the ATLA Annual SA House Price Index. This is a slightly old slide, but the reason for using this is to explain in broad terms what we talk about when we talk about property cycles. You'll note that the 1981 area was deemed to be a major boom area in South African history, and then again the circa 2004 area. But what is also true is that there are secondary cycles, and they tend to be similar cycles. And that gives you the general context of what has been happening over the last number of years in South African property industry. The question we posed was, is the advent of environmental legislation at all related to these cycles, and did we see environmental legislation being drafted because of the property industry? If one, however, I'm sorry, this is not moving forward. There you are. Thank you very much. The lines that you see on the screen now indicate, firstly, the first line on the left is the drafting of the old ECA, the Environmental Conservation Act in 1989. Then we see the introduction of NEMA circa 1998. And then we see specific, I've not included the ECA regulations, but the NEMA regulations 2006 and again 2010. If one asks the question, had environmental legislation been drafted to address specifically the property industry, there is no correlation between the timing of environmental legislation and the property industry or the property cycle. Therefore, we have got to make the assumption that the environmental legislation would have had its source or incentive from other means, but perhaps also needs to be contextualized with an international debate and a general awareness of the environment rather than specific industry types. With this in mind, we ask the question, should there not be a relationship between environmental legislation, regulations, and industry? We also ask the question from a property perspective whether the focus should in fact be on the property development, bearing in mind that the property development is what we call a change agent. Property developer is there to assess current market conditions, to make certain assumptions and certain predictions, and more fundamentally, to take risk. It tries to serve a market, and the question that we ask is, had NEMA or any of the other suite of legislation done anything to educate the market, to create a different market expectation from the property development industry, or is the legislation trying to take on the change agent rather than the market? We feel that there is an absolute need for both the legislator as well as the bureaucracy that implements regulation to have a clear understanding of the industry and the way that it affects it. And then lastly, I think the most important point here is you will note in our submission, in our written submission, that the Western Cape Property Development Forum supports the broad principles of NEMA as set out in the Act. It would be irresponsible as a South African citizen thinking forward to future generations not to consider that to be absolutely essential. The question that we pose, though, is how quickly can those goals be achieved? And we use the reference of referring to this as an evolutionary process versus a revolutionary process. Both processes are about change. The only difference is timing. And with timing, of course, is fallout. And using the analogy of an oil tanker, if you try and turn it too quickly, you will turn it over. Therefore, we don't criticize or question the goals set out by the environmental suite of legislation. We ask whether there has been any clear understanding of how those goals are going to be achieved incrementally to use the Act in a sustainable way. I see. Okay. All right. I'd like to illustrate part of the argument, and we'd like to use the image of a tripod. Now, this could be the outline tripod, any other form of a tripod, but there are three legs. We argue that one of those legs, as per the Act, should represent environment. Another leg should represent society, and the third leg should represent economy. But as we all know, society is not static. The economy is not static, and demands on the environment and society is not static. The Act acknowledges the three legs. The question is, where is the pendulum that swings underneath the structure? It is not static. There will be a time when it swings towards the environment. I would argue that in the period of 2004 to 2007, with major economic boom in this country, the pendulum should have swung towards the environmental side. There will be other conditions that will pull it towards society. But bearing in mind where we are right now, with our lack of job creation, and also what I would call our economic crisis, we argue that there should be acknowledgement that the pendulum must, at the moment, right now, swing towards the economy. The second image...
You're not going to have much support with that argument here.
Mr. Chairman, it's a balance.
It's a balance. It doesn't swing either way.
It is a balance.
You can't win it economically. You're doing well, you go to one side, and then economically you're doing badly, you then relax your regulations so that people can do the economy. It can't work like that. Either it's a principle or it's not a principle.
Mr. Chairman, I hear what you say. The question I think that we were asked as an industry entity to come and talk about is our experience of how this Act is being interpreted practically. And what we are saying is we are still today experiencing that the pendulum is swinging towards the environment and society rather than acknowledging a fair share towards the economy.
I want to, and I'm serious about this, I want to suggest you and your members go and read the State of the Environment report. And you come and tell me where things are bending towards the environment. You read the State of Environment report this country gives out every 5 years. It's actually sickening what we're doing to the environment. There is nothing in this country that we're doing that's bending towards the environment. I can promise you that. If that is your whole assumption from which you work, it's a very wrong assumption. Our environment is under serious, serious, serious problems. So I do suggest go and read the State of Environment Audit, a report that fully looks at all the sectors of our environment and tells you, and you'll see every single one of them in trouble.
Including job creation, sir.
That's not the environment.
You are arguing
that the pendulum has swung towards environment and is swinging more towards environment. And I'm telling you, your assumption is completely and utterly wrong. There's nothing like that at all.
Then there is clearly a lack of communication because I speak from an industry perspective and as a general perception. I take your point. We will work through that document and we will also compare that to various economic documents and job creation documents. What we are advocating for is a sensitivity. We are not saying that every development is correct, nor are we suggesting that every development should overrun economy and society. But what we are saying is that within a property cycle of 7 years, it takes you anywhere between 3 and 7 years to get environmental decision, never mind an authorization or a disproven an application down. There is a problem.
Of course, we agree with that. Any process that's not sticking to the time frame is wrong. and government must not do it.
And if the cause of not sticking to time frames is an abuse of environment or society argument, we also have a problem.
It's not an abuse.
Very often the subsidy...
Look, get on to our point. Get on to appeals. You're completely on the wrong point here.
Mr. Chairman, one of the questions that we pose is whether the appeal process on applications at the moment is a fair process, bearing in mind that any person at NEPA can bring an objection or an appeal with no comebacks in terms of consequences. I must also state that the same goes for any application brought by any government department, whether it be housing or infrastructure or education as well. Put this in context of a 7-year property cycle, you've got to ask yourself, is it not a miracle that you do see some development taking place? Last point, Mr. Chairman, I was asked to highlight a interpretation.
Let me try and understand what you're saying from the industry side. Are you saying that there are applications that are taking 7 years in the appeal process?
I'm saying that the total process, it is not unknown for the environmental process to take anywhere up to that time, sir.
7 years?
I will bring you examples. I can personally talk about a 5-year experience.
Send me any examples of that. I would want the department to respond to that. To say application number 10, whatever of 1920, and this is it, so that I can just have a reference to what it is and we can check what. I'm very keen to see what the holdups were.
Then lastly, sir, the one point that I would like to highlight is the need to try and get the suite of environmental-related legislation to speak to each other, or at least the interpretation of it. The example that I would like to put in front of the committee is the issue of definition of wetlands, watercourses, as read under NEMA versus under the National Water Act. Where we stand at the moment, and I speak here specifically from a Western Cape perspective, we have a situation where one state department, being provincial, interprets it in a specific way, and I would like to present to you a specific report on that, whereas the national department interprets it in a totally different way. The issue at hand here is whether you require water license, and under what instances you require water license. One entity arguing that you need to be applying within a city needs to learn from a defined watercourse being a natural watercourse. Another entity arguing that within 500 meters of a watercourse you might be compelled to bring a application. Whilst this discussion is going on, and this discussion I understand has been ongoing for the last year, it has direct impact on land use development. That is an example, and I will forward you this document separately, of the type of delays that overlays the environmental suite and why perhaps the Act in certain instances is wrongly accused of causing delays versus interpretive issues. And that, Mr. Chairman, to conclude our presentation, is where we would like to see the emphasis. There needs to be a method of fast-tracking and getting clarification orders that transcend individual silos, individual acts, individual sets of regulations, individual departments. If we can achieve that, then a lot of the, what I would call spurious criticism of the Act and regulations, which as I've said, we in principle support, will go away and we will be looking at production. We had a debate now about where the emphasis is, and I take your point that the environment should receive the respect that it requires. But if there are delays due to academic debates on the definition of watercourses, and that causes developments not to take place, never mind being delayed, the argument is that the suite of environmental legislation will be fingered as the culprit, which is not necessary.
Well, I hope that the new amendment to the law, I'm not aware if you're aware of the amendments, part of it is with time delays, and if there are time delays that we're now allowing for a process where the matter can be referred up to the minister. So I do hope that that helps with some of the time delays that takes place. But do give me specific examples when there's been long delays in the appeal. I would want us to get answers to see why that is happening. No other reason, that it's just unacceptable that it takes so long. particularly in the appeal process. I can understand when you still gather information, but the appeal process should never take more than a few months.
To be fair, Mr. Chairman, I think when I talk about long timelines, I talk about the total process, not necessarily any of the processes.
Okay. All right, well, I'll see. Let me not prejudge. Let's get your examples, and then we'll see. Okay? Questions, comments? Mrs. Kosana?
Oh, thanks, Chair. I was just listening to the presenter, and during the presentation, she's always accusing and accusing. I just want to check with him the input thereof to assist in dealing with these issues. Because when something is wrong and you're accusing that wrong part of it, you need to come up with recommendations. What are your recommendations in dealing with this? And also, this issue of an appeal, when you talk about 7 years, then it should have been something done somewhere. You can't stay for 7 years and wait for a presentation. In fact, the time you come and present here and start talking about that, it's better to deal with that immediately as soon as you see your appeal maybe striking. And also, when we talk about this amendment bill, I should think all of us, we must be part of the environment. The manner in which you were presenting is as if you are a side of the environment, but not part of the environment. We must be part of the environment and try to build this legislation to assist us, all of us in fact, not an individual. But the manner in which you have structured your input is as if the department is there, you are there outside the environment, then you throw stones and so on. Then we just get it carried so that you can assist them.
Any other comments, questions? No one? Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I think if I did create the impression that we are criticizing, that's not the intention of our presentation. Our intention is to highlight what property development is experiencing. I thoroughly agree. The process of participation and the Property Development Forum is on record as having made a number of submissions on various bills, both at national and provincial level, and we will continue to do that because we believe that we should participate. The angle is that of the property developer and the experience out there, but I would like to, as a constructive suggestion, conclude the statement that, as we said in my written submission, we support the Act, we support its intentions, there is no difference there. It is how it plays out, how it realizes, and our practical suggestion today would be where there are instances of difference in interpretation, i.e. Vula, there should be a fast-track mechanism to get clarity ASAP. Practically at the moment we sit in a situation where every land use application brought in the Western Cape is sent to Pretoria. I still need to find out how many applications are in fact coming back, and I will get you the data from our members. Part of that is the interpretation issue and the fast-tracking of interpretation and clarification issues. We shouldn't be going to court every time somebody wants to clarify a point.
With which department are these applications being sent to?
That is water affairs.
Huh?
Water affairs.
Water affairs,
yeah. Okay. That is not EIA, but it's the suite that speaks to each other. Remember that I mentioned that this is about water courses. NEMA speaks about water courses. The Water Act speaks about water courses. It's used, in fact, nearly verbatim the same words, yet the interpretation is fundamentally different. And as we stand right now, if the legislation is interpreted as we have been advised it should, then where NEMA decisions are delegated to a provincial level, until such time as the VULA is in place, the NEMA application should not be processed. Whether that is not correct or not, I'm not here to argue. What I'm saying is it has a practical implication, and we've got to solve those problems. It's the timing, it's the process issues that needs to be addressed, not the substance of NEMA or its intention. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I think that we will, as I said, we'll look at some of these issues when you send us the details. Luckily, we also deal with the Department of Water, so we can talk to them and see what the issues are. But I think that your industry needs to go and look at a few things. And firstly, they must see where they fit into society.
You know, if you take away and take away all the words that we speak all the time in government and as a nation, then there's only one word that's important, and that is sustainable development. Well, it's two words, one phrase, sustainable development. That's what everything's about. That is why I'm saying to you that your argument that one should prevail over the other never can be sustained. You have to create the right balances to allow for sustainable development. And the one cannot, when the economy is strong or booming, or your cycle in your property is booming, you can't give preference over the other. And I think we need to look at these things. A system must be certain. It's not dependent on the vicissitudes of whether the economy is strong enough, or whether we as a Department of Environment are stronger than the Department of Economic Affairs. It is a simple thing. The economy, to put it very bluntly, the economy fits into the environment. The environment doesn't fit into the economy. That is what sustainable development means. You can only create a sustainable development if all factors in society pay some allegiance to the sustainability of our ecosystems. And I think that's what you guys must look at. It can't be otherwise. We can't do it in any other way. We can't look at one industry you seem to think that if you throw out the word job creation, that I'm on my knees are going to melt and I'm going to collapse into a little heap of fear because of that we're not creating jobs. But all those things, part of sustainable development is you create jobs in a way that they are sustainable within that environmental framework. You can't do it any other way because then they're not sustainable because they don't create sustainable development. So I just want to make it clear where the committee is coming from. And in fact, yeah, across party lines, you try and argue anything different across party, you won't get anywhere because that's how we view the environment and how it fits in. It has to, of course, facilitate development and so on, must always be done in a sustainable development manner and no other way. If we're not doing that, we're not living up to our constitutional obligations. Simple. Thank you. I want more information, Ms. McCourt, on these processes that take long. So when the gentleman gives the examples, I want you guys to find the facts for me and bring it. So we as a committee can see where the problems are lying, okay? All right, that is, now it is Erasmus Property Owners Association. Are they here? Okay, doesn't matter, you can come along. Again, welcome. Thank you for your time and effort. And if you can take 10 minutes to make your presentation, then we'll start asking your questions or commenting. Let me just check. Tracy Carew, are you here? There you are. Mr. Benzer is here. Ms. Brownlee Kutsia and Ms. Morris. They're listed as individuals. Are you here? No. And then Dube Trade Port is here. Alright, so we still have Erasmus, Carew, Benzer and Trade Port. Four still, okay? From? You're right at the back now because you were late, okay? Thank you. And the time you were given? What time were you given? You were supposed to be here at 3. We went quicker and you weren't here. Okay, that's fine. It'd be good for you to be at the back. It's a good lesson in humility.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next, Mr. Chair, I have submitted comprehensive submissions. I trust they will be dealt with. I will focus on three key points this afternoon. May I, however, before I do so, firstly express my gratitude to Ms. Ngabela, the committee coordinator. Her levels of efficiency and commitment are quite extraordinary.
I don't know whether you're aware, but I've even received a phone call on Sunday evening to make dead sure that I'm aware of a change. At a time when someone...
I have the same pain. I get it continuously.
Okay, and
particularly in the evenings.
We're deeply grateful for what she does, and we hope that the committee values her contribution.
And I really thank you for doing that, because I don't think the staff are always recognized and get the recognition.
It's my pleasure.
I particularly know with Ms. Madubela, she works exceptionally hard. But thank you very much, sir.
Secondly, Mr. Chair, I would want to confirm that I'm making this presentation in my personal capacity,
sure,
and not on behalf of my clients, either be they developers or those opposed to developments. And the reason is really quite simple. If I did say in a professional capacity, my clients would urge me to find resonance with most of the proposals of the committee, namely that things be left more or less as they are, but just improved. My view, however, is that the present system simply does not work. It is evident from a number of things, but I will focus on three. You have stated more eloquently than what I can that a precondition for development is that every generation makes its own scratches on the surface of this environment. And if it didn't, there would be no progress. We'd be doing our business behind the nearest bush. And it's about balance. It's always about finding an appropriate balance between the environment and development, and the notion that we should have unfettered development is as nonsensical as one that we can bubble wrap the environment. Mr. Chair, my biggest concern from day one with the present regime, and I'm extremely concerned that we have simply assumed present system or the present regime to be adequate, and that this exercise of which this committee ought to be commended has sort of got caught up in what Krishnamurti called the tyranny of the known. The fact is, Mr. Chair, there's a simple measure. I was formerly head of the Center for Development Studies at UNISA. As a social scientist, there's a really simple measure to see whether there is any objectivity in the documentation submitted to departments. And I submit there are not. If you would do even superficial research and go and ask yourself how many EIA reports are received by any of the competent authorities that recommend that the proposed activity not be authorized, the answer is none. Similarly, no EIA applications are withdrawn because the applicant has become convinced that the proposed activity is not viable. And the reason is really, really quite simple. It is a fiction to believe that a paid service provider can be objective. And an EAP is nothing more than a paid service provider. I argue in this submission, as I've argued in previous submissions, that there are other ways to anchor the veracity of EIA reporting. And one of the consequences of this particular system, Mr. Chair, is that our environmental authorities are burdened with having to deal with reports they cannot trust. That is why we see so often that even specialist reports are rejected, that EIA reports are questioned, that officials are called upon to do the work that the applicant ought to do. And I will deal with that a little later. I would strongly, strongly urge this committee and the officials who are present to fundamentally revisit how we ensure the objectivity and the reliability of reports that are received. The second point I want to make is one which you touched on tangentially with the previous speaker, and that is that this system of differentiated listings is a nonsense. There are only two kinds of activities. There are those that are likely to have a significant impact on the environment, and there are those that won't. It is scientifically impossible to anticipate what the nature of those impacts will be and how they ought to be assessed. The notion that you can say for a fitting station of one size, you need only a basic assessment, well, in fact, the regulations that they now stand, they've said that up to 80,000 square meters of tanks. You need no environmental impact assessment. Over 80, you need a basic assessment, and over 500, you need a full EIA. It is absurd, because there are many small filling stations. I'm just using them, I could use land areas, land development areas, anyone as an example. The
nature of the assessment to which a proposed activity ought to be subjected must be dictated and determined by the impact it is likely to have, not by its listing. I think the departments have done a sterling job in terms of identifying activities. However, it makes no sense, and it is complicating and compromising the EIA regime to have statutorily defined differences. The fact is that as the system now works, it's a lawyer's dream. Because from a developer's perspective, an adept practitioner can manipulate the system to virtually guarantee an authorization. And a similarly adept practitioner acting for an opposing group can frustrate, delay, and ultimately thwart it, and the actual impacts become almost coincidental. Mr. Chair, that is unacceptable. However, with regard to Mr. Skwasama's point, and that's one of my concerns with those in my fraternity, is it's really easy to stand on the sidelines and throw stones. But very few people actually come up with concrete suggestions. I would suggest that the solution to each of these problems and those that we set out in our submission is that there ought to be only one process, a single, undifferentiated process that is suitably flexible to deal with every conceivable environmental impact assessment. And in a sense, what that means is going back to the regime that was put forward in the 1998 ECA regulations. We have an application, you have a scoping, you have an EIA, and you have an appeal. But this is how the 98 regulations were supposed to work. The problem is that in the 98 regulations, the concept of scoping was perverted, and it grew to have a substantive content. If scoping is limited only to a research proposal, in other words, you can conflate the application and the scoping proposal, you put the obligation on the applicant when he submits or she submits or it submits its submission to have a research proposal that says, this is what I'm proposing, these are the likely impacts, this is how I propose assessing it. Then there is no delay. There's no mini-EIA, there's no authorization at that point. It is simply a research proposal. It enables the authorities to consider what they're supposed to consider. About have the impacts been looked at properly or identified properly? Will they be properly assessed? Who will be doing the assessments? And immediately at the beginning of the process, interested and affected parties are challenged to engage with what is being proposed by way of assessment process. And all the technical delays that come after that are effectively excluded. I would urge this committee not just to look how the present regime can be fine-tuned or improved or made slightly better. I would urge the departments to be a little bolder in terms of their insistence of what would work at a departmental level. And I would strongly urge us to actually face up to how fundamental the flaws are that are contained in our present regime. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just to state up front that as far as the committee is concerned, we put no limitations on to what extent the system has changed. Not the committee. As far as we're concerned, we are for good governance, and if someone comes up with proposals that are better than the ones that exist, we'll have no problems to support that. So the process that we're going through now definitely puts no limitations on the extent of the changes. If it means a whole new system, that then so be it. Obviously, we're guided, of course, by hearing everyone, because that is it. But I want to make it very clear that for us, not an issue of tinkering with it. For us, it's whatever works must work. And if that means big changes, well, it's big changes. So just make that very clear. Just, again, help me. So what would be the big change you're suggesting? I know you're saying that in the 98 regulation there was the scoping and that was completely messed up, became value-driven instead of whatever it should have been. And that you're suggesting that
when the applicant makes the application, that part of it is a research part that is there. Are you saying that those then become a substitute for any possibility of an EIA or so on? Or you say that information then makes the department look at whether there is going to be an impact and then decide whether there's an EIA? Just make that clear to me what it is you suggest.
No, Mr. Chair, I would suggest that any adequate assessment process effectively comprises three stages. One is the application, in which the applicant declares what it wants to do. The second is what was previously and is in some of the regulations still referred to as a scoping phase, which is supposed to be nothing more than something akin to a research proposal, which says, given this proposed activity and the receiving environment, here is a proposal on how the impact it may have ought to be assessed. And Mr. Chair, let's use an item listed in Listing Notice 2, which is assumed to have a massive impact, but which may not. In the scoping and in the application, a proposal can be put forward which could see that scoping exercise finished in the next 3 or 4 months. Similarly, an item listed in Listing Notice Number 1, which is assumed to have likely to have little impact, but which may have significant impact, that will become clear right then. And what the department is called on to decide at that point is the adequacy of the processes that will generate the reports on which their eventual decisions will be based. That's where a decision, a substantive decision by Department of Government is needed, is have the potential impact been correctly identified, and is the assessment protocol that is being proposed sufficient? It is also at that point that interested and affected parties are called on to make the inputs on what they reckon needs to be done. And that fight can be had right at the beginning of the process. Then what happens is, out of that comes an EIA phase, where then an assessment is done, it results in an EIA report, which resonates with the scoping report. And that's the end of the process. It works in every instance. It is suitably flexible so that if there's an activity that's likely to have lesser impact, there will be a short report. Greater impacts, whatever the listing, it will be a more complex report.
The introduction of the EMFs,
and that they've been rolled out quite substantially now and being agreed to by a government. 18 have been agreed to and 22 others are on the pipeline, and then there's another 100 coming. Does that change any of your views?
No, Mr. Chair. I'm fairly strongly in favour of environmental management frameworks. I think they've been developed responsibly. And they said, but the same thing applies there, is if there is compliance.
I tell you what, I wasn't finishing my question. What I like about the EMFs is that it reduces your reliance on lists more and more. Because it says to you, you can do this. If you want to do this, you must do this, but this you can't do at all. So immediately up front, all of us know. If you want to go and build something there, forget it. It's up front. It's in that sense then that your critique of the listing, I think then starts changing, because it's not necessarily the listing anymore. It is the EMF that then dictates how we're going to act there. And that creates more flexibility and more certainty and so on. So it's in that sense I'm asking, does that change at all your what you're suggesting?
Mr. Chair, no. What would happen is that within an EMF, if there is an application for particular authorization, the same phases would be required, excepting where they are entirely unnecessary. But again, the same simple process, it's a standard process. You tell us what you want to do, how you're going to do it, and if the competent authority and elected parties are happy, you then implement that. If it means that in this particular context there's no assessment required, that's fine.
Any comments, any questions? Anything from members? Dr. Huang?
Thank you, Chairperson. I just drew to your presentation. You say it's for a listing, a different listing, or without the EIA that reports. I'd like to know if your different listing is what's the concern from your own association. And your process is applied for the EIA. Through the EIA report is approved for the take of the loan process. like the last speaker said, it's about a 7-year circle. So I'd like to know, is it quite clear for me, not too clear for your listening thing?
I just clarify, my understanding of the question is that, I'm being asked whether the proposal I make would foreshorten the period from application to approval. Mr. Chair, may I make a few comments? My experience is that as many, if not more, delays are experienced due to the incompetence of the applicant and its team than to the way in which these processes are managed inside the departments. I don't think there's been any substantive research done in this field, but it is my experience that when you push them, the departments respond. I think what the process that I propose does do is it holds the applicant responsible for how long the process will take. It ensures that the applicant is placed under pressure to provide responsible and reliable reporting on which a decision is possible. I do not believe that it excludes completely the possibility of extensive delays, but if such a process is implemented, I do not think that will be common or the norm.
No, you can't participate, sir. When you come and make your submission, you make your submission. Only members of the committee participate in the proceedings. Mr. Rogers, is that a hand? No. Ms. McCourt?
Chair, I think I just want to add one element. There's actually three fundamental steps in an EIA process. In the international conceptualization of the principle of environmental impact assessment. The first of that is screening. You have screening, scoping, and assessment. These are three steps that you have. In terms of the approach followed in South Africa, and the screening is linked to the issue around determining the likelihood of having substantial detrimental impacts on the environment. Now, there is different ways in which you can do the screening. The approach that we followed, because we are in a developmental state as a country with limited baseline information really readily available across the country and specifically in the rural areas, is to use the listing exercise as the process giving effect to the screening, which is where you are determining the likelihood of the impact.
So you screen through broad categories?
You screen it through broad categories, and that's where the thresholds fit in, and that is the same, the issue that I raised this morning about the three things that impact on that is the nature of the activity itself, that regardless of where this activity takes place, it will have an impact, and it's a highly polluting activity. The other one is around the extent of the activity, just to remind in terms of me making candles in my backyard versus a factory that produces candles. And the scale. The third one relates to the nature of the receiving environment. And that is why we have in 2010 included the third list instead of compiling everything into one list, is to say your filling station, regardless of threshold, if it takes place in this sensitive environment, it has the likelihood of having a substantial detrimental impact on the environment. In terms of the differentiation between the scoping and the assessment phase, it is important that we've tried to restore that original intent in the 2010 regulations of making the differentiation between scoping and assessment. But the reality that you, in some instances, need very limited assessment is why the basic assessment report in which combine scoping and assessment into one step with shorter timeframes. There is, however, still the ability in the Act, and you've improved that again through the NEMLA 2 of this year, to both upscale or downscale. So if in your scoping exercise for activity listed in Listing Notes 2, it is established that it is not in fact justifying to do a full assessment. There is an ability to make a decision at that point in time after scoping. Similarly, if you're in a basic assessment process in that original phase of scoping, establish that regardless of the screening being anticipated to have a limited impact on the effect, it actually, in fact, has to be upscaled to an environmental assessment. So I think we've tried to build in that flexibility, but the screening has been done through the listing. I think that is just the important step in between. I think in terms of restoring the full intent of what Scoping International does, we agree with, and that's why we've made those amendments in 2010. But I think we do need to build in the flexibility that you don't necessarily only going to have a research proposal. You are going to have some limited general assessment requirement, even if it is just around the public consultation process and getting the social buy-in into this process, and therefore you have the basic assessment process. So I think, of course, it can be improved.
But the part I like, I can't pretend I understand everything, but the part I like is the part put more obligation on the applicant. I think that seems to me as a principle, what Mr. Erasmus is saying, is probably very vital. Now, how one does that, take into consideration our levels of development, our information available, particularly in rural areas, that may differ, and it may be, you know, an issue of debate. But I do think that, you know, we've debated it in a different way. We've said earlier, why aren't we having a cutoff? That where the applicant has to respond to something, why are we letting it drag on for 2 years, 3 years? Why don't we say after 6 months we close the file and that's it? You want to apply, you start again. So that the obligation is on the applicant to make sure that they provide the necessary information. So I think that principle seemed to me to be a good one. There's something that, how one then does it, of course, you know, there can be some debate about it. Mr. Erasmus again?
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'm in agreement with a great deal of what the department has said. In my presentation, the application process, as I refer to it, and the conflation of that with the scoping included the screening. My concern is the following. We may be a developing country, okay, but we have an absolute responsibility towards the environment. And you cannot screen with broad brushstrokes. My concern with the present listing, and as I say, I think the departments need to be commended in terms of what the listings in their totality include. It seems to me environmentally irresponsible to have that as the final word in terms of screening. What I'm suggesting is that within the context of a comprehensive single listing notice, the obligation is on the applicant to apply an appropriately sophisticated screening methodology, which then gets presented to the department. So in terms of the process, and Mr. Chair, just to give you a practical example, this upscaling and downscaling of a basic assessment by way of example doesn't work. Because what happens is the applicant does the entire process without ever consulting the interests of elected parties. And only once the basic assessment report in its final format is ready does he talk to the member of the public. There should be a point before the assessment process happens where interested and affected parties can ask for it to be upscaled or to be downscaled. That does not appear in our present regulation.
Mr. Wolves, can we make sure these points are in the report and that you guys respond to it in terms of possibilities? As I say, I don't want to pretend that I understand. Well, I'm new in this area, so... But I hear what you're saying, and there's some things that find resonance with me, but the problem is because I don't know the extent of how these systems work, it's difficult to apply my mind to it. So I wanted this to be part of the report, and so that it's fleshed out more what has been proposed and then what the department is saying about it. Okay, that's clear. Okay, thank you very much. Anyone else, sorry? Happy? Okay. Thanks, Mr. Erasmus. Thank you very much for your time and effort, and once again for being thoughtful about these issues. Teresa Carew, Miss LaRue, is it? Ford, ma'am? You have to love the Carew a lot to say it's Teresa Carew. Very piece of God-forsaken earth. You may object strongly. Because I'm saying it tongue-in-cheek. I love the Karoo. I think it's beautiful. Beautifully ugly. Yeah, until I look in the mirror. There you see ugly. Okay, Mr. LaRue, welcome. And thanks for taking the effort and the time. I know you wanted to be there before 3, we looked for you, but you weren't around, so we apologize. No, it's fine, it's fine. You have 10 minutes, and then we'll engage with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm just going to speak very briefly. My colleague was supposed to be here to speak about some of the other aspects that I'm not going to speak about at the moment. Just as a point of departure, these are the current applications for shale gas in South Africa. The yellow piece of shale in the middle, the small red block is Bundu, and the blue is Falcon. They applied for exploration rights. All the other areas, the orange and the pink, are for technical cooperation permits. The three applications at the bottom, along with an application by Sasol around the Drakensberg area, spanned about a fifth of South Africa's land surface area.
Ma'am, you must know how to drive ox wagons if you're going to use this thing. It comes from a bygone age. I'm dealing with this.
Sorry, the background is white. I don't know what the thing is like. Okay, so the scope and scale of the current applications span about a fifth of South Africa's land surface area. There are many unknowns regarding the technology and the receiving environment, the baseline information. The geology in the crew is relatively well understood up to about 400 meters deep. The proposed activities would take place far below that. There is a need for individual EIAs per drilling location due to varying geology and ecology, as well as strategic environmental assessment for cumulative impacts, trucks, the flaring, the waste, pipelines, well pads, and additional infrastructure and development. EIA considerations specifically with regard to shale gas. At the moment, drilling is not a listed activity, and it might be a possible loophole. We are aware that hydraulic fracturing has been declared a controlled activity, and we support the declaration of it. But the fact that drilling is not a listed activity is possibly a concern to us. The Karoo geology is very different to other shale plays overseas. It is unique. It is very risky. It's got a lot of dolerite intrusions that none of the other shale plays have in the world. It also has existing natural faults and fracture systems. In 1967, Scott drilled for oil in the Karoo around Klip Klop in Jansenville. At a depth of about 2,400 meters deep, they encountered a total loss of drilling fluid and pressure. 6 weeks later, 35 kilometers away, a farmer picked up a brown sediment coming out of the spring. When the technician from Sukkot tested the water and the sediment in the stream, they realized that it's the same chemicals and drilling mud that they've been using 35 kilometers away 6 weeks ago when drilling as well. I'm using this just to illustrate the complexity of the fact that the geology is so unknown. There's also a need for better protection, more explicit protection for groundwater. In general, in discussions regarding EIAs, ecosystem services have also been neglected. And in areas of agricultural significance, this is also of concern. There's a bit of a disconnect between NEMA and the NPRDA. When mining companies apply for authorizations or for projects to be approved, they have to do an EMP first, and then after they have the exploration right, only do they do EIAs, and then following another EMP. And especially with an activity like hydraulic fracturing on the scale, those steps, which has not been taken place in South Africa before, it is important to not only start with an EMP, but to start with an EIA, which is not the way that mining applications are currently being processed.
I can just say to you on this that there is a piece of legislation that's now been introduced. There's also one in the committee that deals with minerals, dealing with the aspects, and we will be asking for a full briefing from the department, from the two, to explain all the processes, particularly the synchronization of the process. So please just watch the media so that you guys can give inputs into that. We will be dealing with it when we deal there.
There's also a need for standardized license procedures. It's something that a lot of the other presentations have also alluded to, so I'm not going into a lot of detail about that. In general, when commenting on some of the latest laws and amendments that have come to our attention, there seems to be a push by government to fast-track some specific sectors or specific projects that they have identified for the benefits of development and job creation. And it's of some concern because, for example, the infrastructure bill disregards the time frames allowed within environmental authorizations and seems to fast-track and disregard those time frames in order to approve the specific development. Also, in the latest MPRD amendment bill, they talk about fast-tracking developments of strategic minerals, and it is likely that shale gas will also be seen as a strategic mineral. And it raises some questions around what the type of authorization in terms of the environmental impacts would be of these specific developments and the developments of these minerals. There's not a lot of clarity on that.
As I understand these things, and I can't vouch for it completely, but as I understand it, when it's talked about fast-tracking, the idea is not the time frames, it's the fragmentation. The fact that you have 9 provinces and national to deal with environmental issues, you can get 10 different seasons and 10 different criteria. So what government is looking at is when it comes to huge infrastructure projects or huge developmental projects, when you talk about fast-tracking, what they're talking about is to make sure that those decisions are, for example, made in one place at national. So that you don't like renewable energy. We found already with renewable energy 9 provinces with different capacities, they don't do the work, so you don't get things done. So I think that's what you have to look at with this, and that's what the intention is. I can't vouch that I've read all these things and say that's not what you're saying here, but the intention is something different than this. The intention is really to make sure that the way government is fragmented, I mean, all, for example, the farmers kind of spoke here today and told us it's difficult for them when they have to work with the Department of Agriculture, Department of Environment, locally and nationally. And so what these ideas are, that those big infrastructure projects will actually be done at a national level. So the laws will still apply, the environmental laws. If you can look at our latest amendments, we actually deal with this issue. We say that Cabinet must declare something a national priority. And then only when that has happened, then nationally the decisions are taken and the impact statements are done. Because there's more capacity, there's more uniformity at that level. So that's just to try and give you some background to what the intention is with these things.
And the last point that I'd like to make and then conclude with it is that when applications are lodged for shale gas exploration and mining, I think it is very important that a minimum requirement would be baseline information on the existing environment and as a minimum groundwater and air quality baseline studies. Because a lot of the discussions and the disagreements around some of the impacts overseas take place in the vacuum and within the context of a lack of baseline information and a lack of baseline data. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we, as a committee, has previously stated publicly that we obviously don't want to preempt the issues around fracking, but one thing will be sure that when these matters are dealt with, that this committee will very, very carefully scrutinize the work of our department, make sure that the work is done properly. And to be fair to the department, they're not sitting on their backside. They're already doing work around these things quietly behind the scenes. And I'll say this publicly because people must know that government is already doing those things. Okay, questions, comments? Seems it's quite clear. And as we said previously, we'll watch this one carefully.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am. Now it is Mr. Benches. Please step forward, sir. Welcome. Another old visitor who spends more time here than at home. Welcome once again, and you know the drill, 10 minutes, and we'll jump in with some issues.
Thanks, sir. Whenever I come here, I get overwhelmed by all the technical expertise of lawyers and engineers and all those people, and I'm just little me. I want to address a few things, but first I also want to say how daunting it is to sit in this chair right after Ali Erasmus and his eloquence. but I support a lot of what he has to say. And I would like to come here rather as an interested and affected party and to point out one or two things. First of all, I agree that there's absolutely no way that you can say an EIA is fair and balanced when the payment of the practitioner comes from the developer. There has to be a mechanism that is put in place where whatever fee structure or funding model is, that funding goes into a fund and somehow a practitioner is appointed from that fund and can have very little connection to the developer. And that way we could find some measure of fairness. At the same time that you appoint that practitioner, you need to appoint somebody to represent the interests of the public or the interested and affected parties. I've taken part in two very large EIAs, and both of them were airports, one in Nelspruit and one in KZN. And in both instances, the interested and affected parties were literally bullied by the developers. The minute something was raised, it was a box-ticking exercise. Now we'll take that into account. Don't worry, you'll see it in the report. And that was the end of it. And that is a very serious issue. And I'd like to also refer now, we have the issue of the mining in Umtanzini, where the people of Umtanzini are getting bulldozed out of the way with this mining issue. And that needs to be addressed very carefully. So somehow a mechanism must be found where interested and affected parties and members of the public are represented properly in the process. And I think it's very, very clear that we need to do that. Next point I'd like to make is what happens after the project is finished. I participated in the Kinshaka very long, very arduous EIA as an interested and affected party. The airport record of decision was granted after some appeals. And 3.5 years later, we're still grappling with the issue of noise. And one of the issues that's become very apparent is the loss of the birds, the famous swallows, at the end of the roadway, and nobody seems to be able to deal with that issue. And I have to ask what happens afterwards. And then, of course, there's the most critical one of all, and that is this issue of when you allow us to do this, or you give us the permission or whatever, authorization, we're going to create so many jobs. And you and I have spoken about this before at a previous hearing. Because you hear figures, and in the Kinshasa Airport one, the figure given was 62,500 jobs would be created. Well, if 2,000 jobs have been created, I'd be very, very surprised. And similarly, going back to the issue, lots and lots of jobs have been promised. And on the back of that, this project is going forward. If you go up the road to Hillendale, you see just how many jobs have actually been created there. It's about 300 or 400. And to me, this is something that needs to be addressed. And the way I would suggest it's done, chap comes along and says, here's my EIA, we're going to create so many jobs. You have to get him to sign a document. For every job short, you guys are for it for a year. So if you say 10,000 jobs and it's 9,000, you are responsible to pay for that extra 1,000. And the minute you start doing that, you're going to start seeing reality hit. And that's really what we need to get to. Jobs is very, very important, but false jobs is something that we don't need. And to use that and abuse that to get environmental authorization is just not up. And I think we need to address that. Final thing I'd like to address is the enforcement of environmental regulations at all three levels of government. Right where I live in Belito, we have two or three instances where developers have just said, tough, we're going to do it. One left us with a very empty, derelict shopping center, and one has left us with a disaster on a very pristine beach, which creates jobs in itself, tourism. So we need to come up with a stronger regime, more powerful, the lesser governments, local and provincial, and that needs to be enforced. And those are my points, and thank you.
You know, this is the second time today that this issue has been raised, and I like this issue more and more when I hear it, is that as developers are coming up with their plans and padding it with all kind of information, that there's no real outcome. I mean, AfriForum called a document, which is terms and conditions,
what promises do they make to the public that engage with them in the process, and then they don't have to live up with it? And I really am starting to see the light on this issue. Mr. Wiltz, it must be a major part of your report. And I want to see what it is you can do. Whether it is to sign a certificate or whether it is... But I can see where it's coming from. I mean, if these guys, if you get, if people are opposing it, your project, and you make promises to them and say to them, but we're going to create 65,000 jobs. I mean, you know, don't you want it? I mean, if people are going to make promises like that, there has to be somehow that they can be held to account on it. And so I like this idea. I don't know the consequences of it, but I really like the idea. So please, Mr. Wills, we want this issue to be addressed, okay? All right, questions, comments? We like this one, eh? We like that there's a consequence to what you promise. Because imagine if you're poor and you're objecting to a project next to you, and someone says to you, no, but we're going to create 1,000 jobs for you. And they just know that's a lie. And that there's no consequence to lying. And actually just undermining the whole public participation process in the process. Mr. Rogers?
Yeah, I want to concur with you, because it's almost as though once we've issued the EIA, we just walk away from the entire project. And what we were hearing earlier and what we've heard is that people give false information, and we were talking about outputting legislation or regulations of those with severe consequences for people who are misinforming us and who are misinforming the communities. So, yeah, it's something that needs to take priority. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, so that we're going to look at more. And of course, all the issues you raised, but this is one that I think is starting to crystallize. Thank you, Avengers. Much appreciated. Nice to see you again. Ms. Brownlee, Ms. Kutsia, Ms. Morris? Not here. Okay, they go to the back of the queue. Dube Port has been sitting patiently the whole day. Come. Dube Treport. She's in the back of the queue. Simple. The time we give is the time they give their input, but that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be here earlier. Who is there?
Thank you, Chair. We're just waiting for the presentation to be loaded onto the
system. That's fine. Welcome. Thanks for being patient, and thanks for taking the effort. You have 10 minutes, and I imagine you're not Miss Rolf.
No, she is just sitting,
she's sitting next to
me. My name is Owen Mungwe.
Mungwe, okay.
If I may, just a while, loading up the presentation and just contextualize sort of our submission and where we're at this point in time. Obviously, I mean, we've made our submission based on the experience on the ground that we have experienced, you know, I mean, over the years, you know, of executing, you know, the project. And also just to contextualize it, I will just skip through the presentation. Just try and save some time and also not repeat the issues or the points that have been raised, and sitting down there and listening to some of the submissions, you know, I mean, we felt that, you know, some of the points have already been dealt with, you've already answered or given the committee's position if we can just secure indulgence in that approach. Just to maybe, like, unlike most of the organizations that have actually, I mean, or the submissions have been made, you know, to the trade board is not necessarily well known, you know, within a whole host of other people. Just to contextualize, we are legislated an entity within the provincial spheres of KwaZulu-Natal government. We're the home of King Shaka International. We've got a 6-year master plan, and our drive really is to be a catalyst for global business and trade environment, and looking at integrated supply chains, you know, accelerate efficiencies and offer business, you know, agility to compete globally. Obviously, focusing predominantly on air cargo related activities. And just skipping through speedily in terms of land ownership to contextualize, I mean, the presentation, AXA owns, you know, the yellow boshin, which is an H shape, you know, within the presentation, and there is a joint venture operations between Airports Company of South Africa and Dube Trade Port. So in total, the site is about 2,040 hectares, but Dube Trade Port has gone acquired additional land, you know, which is approximately about close to 100 hectares or 340 hectares over and above what is actually shown here. This is one of the recent land acquisition as part of the objectives of the organization. And we have, I mean, a 6-year master plan that I've obviously referred to. This is the ultimate wish that the organization has, and it is on a sort of like a similar or related basis that we got cabinet approval for us to undertake the project. Just, Mr. Chair, if I may, you know, just to give you a bit of an indication of some of the current projects that we will be busy with. We've got quite a few applications currently sitting with the Department of Economic, Department of Environmental Affairs, and including the ROD amendment application, which was, this is referring to the original ROD. This just gives you, an indication of the developments that we are currently busy with. They're at various stages, you know, some of them are at scoping stage, some of them already under execution, but most of them, you know, I mean, still at an early age of the project. Then in dealing with our submission, I would just basically I will skip this this one point because I think a lot of has been said in that in this regard. The one point that would actually wish to contribute to towards land development processes, you know, from our perspective and experience, is that if they could basically a way and a means of truly integrating some of the application processes, you know, we find that, you know, having undertaken, you know, different applications, you know, to obviously different spheres of government, and there are degrees or elements of interdependencies, you know, yield or result in actually a long time, you know, for us to actually go through the processes and, you know, from development processes, find that, you know, there's a good period, which could range between 2 to 3 years, you know, before you can actually undertake, you know, a development, especially within an environment whereby you have a 6-year master plan and already, you know, some of the, you've got a development framework, you know, that has been approved by the municipalities, but there is just no sort of integration that seems to be, or we're hoping that, you know, the legislation could actually look at some of the integrations, you know, with other application processes. And I will again skip the slide that talks about, you know, the balancing issues that's been dealt with. The other point that we'll actually raise and maybe just to try and address is the issue of, you know, the standardization, you know, in particular in our case, you know, in dealing with the issues of offset, whereby we've seen a degree without fully understanding, you know, the rationale for that, you know, a degree of inconsistencies in actually awarding, you know, certain, approvals. For example, you know, we use the case of Cornubia versus the trade port site, you know, which is within a 15-kilometer, radius of each other. And in the case of Dube Trade Port, on the issue of offset, was these wetlands, offset, were given a ratio of 1:3. But in the site that is just 15 kilometers away, they're basically working on a hectare-to-hectare equivalent. I mean, and if you try to actually get sort of a rationale and understanding of why there was such a differentiation, you know, I mean, it's, one cannot obviously get, I mean, at this stage, sort of a clear response. So what we basically be appealing for maybe is just a degree of standardization or the guidelines, you know, or the rules that actually say, you know, I mean, for a development of this nature within such an environment, these are the guidelines that will actually, that we have to work within. Otherwise, you know, they could basically be a degree.
What is offset in this sense?
In this instance, Mr. Chairman, we're looking at the wetlands offset. We had applied, I mean, there were some wetlands that were being destroyed during the construction of the first phase. And this was the offset ratio. So for every wetland that we destroyed, we had to, for every 1 hectare wetland we destroyed, we had to replace that by 3 hectares.
Ooh, we're very lucky it wasn't me who gave the authority. Ooh, it would be more than 3. Much more. Destroying a wetland. Like killing your mother.
Yeah, it's
killing your granny.
It's granted, Chair, but what we actually requesting is...
Now, you worry about the standardization, yes. In another instance it was absolutely not as long. Yeah, but you got the big bucks, so...
These are taxpayers' money, Chair.
That's why I'm amazed you worried about it.
We're a responsible organization. And then just moving on again. On
I mean, you can see the seriousness of destroying wetlands. I mean, if you're getting away with 1 in 3, hell, man, it's a bargain. Because for us, we that are, our wetlands have now been killed, we can never get it back.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I do understand the point is why others don't get equally dealt with. I suppose there should be some kind of analogy. Okay, go on. I understand now what it's about.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. And also, I mean, I think along the same similar principles, you know, I mean, if we could also be given an opportunity, you know, just as a practice to also offer, you know, off-site, you know, offsets, you know, in some instances you find that you would not necessarily have sufficient wetlands, you know, that you can actually replace within the your own site, that if you can actually go and acquire pieces of land to actually retain and rehabilitate some of those wetlands. And I'll just skip this part. The other point that basically I would once wish to address is once the project has progressed to detailed design and construction, due to some unknown factors, you know, you find that you actually have some slight changes, you know, I mean, within the execution process. We find that sometimes, you know, there are certain challenges in that you can't really stop, you know, the works and the construction, you know, because you have to change your construction methodology. So, I mean, what we are appealing for is actually just a degree of flexibility and accommodating, I mean, the developers and for us not to actually delay the projects, you know, in detail, I mean, for a long time whilst we actually seeking for adjustments, I mean, within our plans. And then the last point that we actually just wish to raise, I think in principle this, I mean, also talks to, I mean, sort of maybe an approach of an EMF of sorts, you know, whereby we think, I mean, there is a need, greater need, basic for guidance on the no-go zone and sensitive areas. If you ring fence all of those, at least then you would know that, I mean, you would not necessarily, I mean, undertake any development, you know, along the ring fenced or no-go zones. And, Chair, I think that just basically, I mean, brings, you know, the key 4 points that we wish to actually contribute. We did have other points, and I think as I've indicated earlier on, you dealt with them, and we fully understand the approach and the position of the committee in that regard. Thank you.
I think with the issues you're raising at the end here, it depends on the development. I mean, if it's a recurring development, the department has been quite clear that there's regulations to allow for and to minimize your regulatory framework. But the issue is if you built an airport and you're now starting to want to build industrial zones and stuff, I mean, clearly there has to be another EIA because it's a completely different activity. So I think one must just be balanced about it. If it's a recurring issue of extending the landing strip or something, then I can understand it should be easier. But if you're now going to create a whole factory industrial area around the airport or a whole office area around, I mean, clearly you just have to have another EIA because it's something new now. It's going to have a different impact. Any case, I must say that I like the Kinshark Airport. I think it's nice. I know the swallows have disappeared, but maybe what you should be looking at as Dubai Trade Port is bringing some more swallows back there, looking after them. Then people are going to be happy. We all want to go there. We want to see the swallows when we go there. Now you've messed up our swallows. It's terrible. One. Yeah. For every swallow that disappeared, I want three more swallows back there. Mrs. McCourt?
Chair, I think the whole Dubai Trade Port, Kinshasa Airport, is a very good demonstration of the complexity of EIAs. Because I was personally involved in this, let me just declare this up front. But the issue is that it is an ecologically incredibly, incredibly sensitive area. And if you strictly went in terms of purely environmental impact, the decision should probably have been no. But we have to look in terms of the bigger context of sustainable development in terms of need and desirability. And that is directly linked to what the offset agreement is. At the time when that offset agreement, negotiated offset agreement, resulted in the positive decision on the way forward, it was not contested. So it's very much similar to the jobs issue. About this is what was put
make,
on the table.
Make promises to get things moving.
This was what put on the table in order to justify the environmental impact. So, whilst I agree that there needs to be a framework for offset, and that has subsequently, by the way, in terms of biodiversity offsets, have been finalised. In terms of bigger environmental offsets, we are still working with. There will still be fluctuations depending on what is justified in terms of what you are sacrificing in that specific instance. And it needs to be done in a hierarchy of biodiversity mitigation, which is first the avoidance, which wasn't possible here, then mitigation and management, and offset only as the last resort where you cannot have either one of those two. So yes, the framework needs to be there, and it thankfully is there now. But there will be differentiation depending on what has influenced that specific decision. Also, in terms of how the approach, we would have preferred at the time to consider the entire Dubai Port, and we do that in terms of industrial zones generally, where you consider the changed land use aspects in one application and try to delineate the conservation areas, etc. There was commitments made in terms of that conservation area that wasn't followed through, which is now impacting on the decisions going forward. The conservation area had to be delineated in the Dubai Trade Port area, the on-site conservation area, not the offsets. I'm not talking about the offsets now. Before the rest of the trade port could be developed. And that hasn't proceeded. They haven't done a delineation, and then now we are falling behind in terms of the other individual authorizations because there's a conditionality there. And I think that integration of the system is incredibly important when we look at these things.
It's good that these things come here because we hear these things. Now I've heard it. Now I'm sure that what you're going to do for me, sir, is you're going to go back and you immediately sort the problem out. The conservation areas you should have put in place, which you didn't. I know you're going to commit yourself publicly now when you speak and say, I'm going to make sure I do it. So okay, I'm going to give you a chance to publicly say that, okay?
Thank you, Chair. And we really welcome, the creation and establishment of the framework, you know, with respect to the wetland offset programs and with clear guidelines because, admittedly, we sometimes do feel aggrieved, in the developments whereby some of the authorities are involved, there seems to be, a degree of flexibility and
favoritism, and when those authorities are not involved in them, there are punitive measures that are actually, I mean, given against developers. On the issue of the conservation area, I mean, we all know that there is an issue with respect to that, I mean, process. It is not DTP's no access fault at this stage, but you know that whole conservation, I mean, delineation process never took place on time. You know, the ROD, you know, through the appeal process whereby the minister actually advised that an advisory forum needed to be set up that will actually work on the delineation of the conservation area and so forth. That is the part that actually delayed the whole process. But in response to that, we're also actually waiting for the advisory forum to function, you know, to be both to the trade board and AXA actually went through the process of getting the specialists on board, you know, in terms of the ecologists and so forth, to try and actually do some of the rehabilitation activities on the areas that we knew that were not necessarily contested within the whole conservation area. So,
I publicly promise you and everyone present that when I get back, this will be number one priority on my desk. Is that the word you wanted to end off with?
Yes, sir, that's an answer, I know.
Oh, I love it when a plan comes together. It's like, you know, the leader of the A-team. He likes it when a plan comes together. No, I think let's thank you for the input. What your input does, it makes one, of course, look also at bigger projects and how and the kind of complications and the difficulties. I think clear that that is the kind of thing which is more important is the really big projects and big impacts they could have. And your examples you've given us give us some food for thought, and we will take it on board. And then we thank you that you're going to sort out your little conservation area that we can come and look at when we come and fly your aeroplane there. Thank you. Sorry, ma'am, was there something you wanted to add, maybe? You happy? Okay. Sorry. Didn't I give you a chance? Sorry, I apologize. Ms. Wenger, I do apologize.
No, that's not a problem. Thank you for the presentation. Chair, but I think there's also complexities involved with that, as you heard from the department. If they don't meet part of their deals and things are delayed, then I'm sorry for them. They're either going to stick to the conditions of the agreement and those authorization, or they're not going to. And if they're not, then they deserve to wait. And because there's a lot of inconveniences and communities and all sorts of things involved in this. And we can't just do a piecemeal here. It's got to be fully compliant before you can even consider going anywhere further.
No, I think that's the correct approach. Mr. Rogers?
I want to add to that. I'm a bit confused. This is a 60-year project. And I assume the project has phases over the 60 years. And in the original application, the entire project was proposed, or was it being done piecemeal and being given license piecemeal? Because if the entire project was not put forward in its original application, and now there are deviations, then this process must be followed, the normal process like everyone else. I think in yesterday's discussions we were saying, it's also up to developers to make sure that they do the proper planning, and that when they hit a crisis, they don't try and blame the department or us for non-function. Proper planning starts at home, the principle of five P's, sorry.
I've actually, by that picture of yours, I've understood you doing it in phases, which Mr. Rogers, and of course when one does it like that, then all the complications that Mr. Rogers has mentioned will be part of the problem. But respond if you would.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe just to contextualize, indeed the project is done in phases, and I think from our perspective, you know, we've never really wanted to
avoid any EA processes. You know, I mean, we go through those. I mean, currently, if my memory serves me well, we've got, I mean, on average, about 4 or 5 different applications with EA, and we do follow the due process in terms of the public participation processes. We do everything according to the book of law. What we're raising in this context was just basically inconsistencies that we've actually picked up as we were going along, you know, in the execution of the project. However, we intend to comply with all the regulations, I mean, as we have been even in the past. Thank you.
Okay. Good. Thanks a lot. Give regards to KwaZulu-Natal, my birthplace. She built the airport in Ishowe. That's where I was born. Yeah. Stand a bit more north than that. In the Bundus. All right, so we go back. We finish now. We go back to the South African Property Owners Association, Advocate P. Matsane. Not the right name. Yeah, with that accent, you don't sound like a Matsane.
We also agree in raising environmental improvement. We're with the department on that. However, our main point, as we put in our paper, is to make the process efficient and quick and businesslike, and our paper really focuses on that to try and see how we can actually make whatever decisions are being made quickly and efficiently. Not to make the process less rigorous, but rather to make sure there's no queues, so there's no applications waiting to be dealt with, but that all the applications are dealt with in an efficient and effective manner. That's really our focus here today. So we're dealing with speed, we're dealing with the balance between the environment, the green environment and the social economic environment, and we're dealing with ways how to make things more efficient. We agree with one of the other speakers, Kelly, who was talking about making the one process, the EIA, the making the one bar and then a scoping and assessment process, but reducing that to one. And we also agree with bringing the public participation in at the beginning, because again, especially with the longer process, you have one something happening, then a PPP, and then something else happening, then another PPP, and it just it makes the process far too long. And if we've got a developer trying to build social housing with the 100 million rand loan on the land, and if the process takes a year, then he's spent the best part maybe of 10 million rand just waiting. If it can be done in a month, there's a lot more money that can go into housing and a lot less. It's not going forward. Oh, I see.
Start with your name and surname, please.
Sorry, Advocate Douglas Shaw.
Douglas Shaw, okay.
So talking about this balance thing, I think we kind of touch it a bit. We'd like to see it actually a principle in the regulations explicitly, more than it already is, that projects with large environmental costs and marginal benefits, we should not see projects with large environmental costs and marginal economic benefits going ahead, and we should not see projects with small environmental costs and large economic costs being rejected or delayed. It's a question of balance, and we like actual institutions where we can appeal very quickly and get somebody to look at the situation when that happens. So what kind of time limits are we talking about? As you know, the time limits renew automatically in a legislation. We don't think they should. We'd like to see the process time limits being reduced on average. We understand there are some cases where environmental needs mean they must be longer, but we're trying to get rid of the queuing in the process. So we're looking at 60 days for bar if there's going to be two, and 90 days for longer process. So we think that there's some processes, if our processes were professionally re-engineered, then we could get some down to 30 days or even 10 days for very nominal things. And that's what we think should happen. people have been talking about bringing PROCES together, one-stop shop, and I believe we need to get consultants in and really go for this, and we're willing to pay for it if necessary, or we can negotiate things about that. So making decisions quickly, not having applications queued, I think I've covered this already.
Have you seen the latest amendment that we've done?
I don't think I have.
Well, there is an amendment we've passed whereby if the time frames are not met at different levels of government, there's a process now that allows you to escalate the matter up to the national minister.
Which sounds
so
good news.
As soon as time limits are up, then you can escalate.
Great.
So we would and then the minister has certain obligations and so on.
Yeah. Well, we see that as a good positive step in the right direction. By the way, we don't mind engaging the department with this and bringing consultants and bringing people in and helping with the process. So it's not just either idea and good luck. We'd like to actually engage and talk. Fast-track pay processes must be implemented. What do I mean by that? This is a thing that's actually been tried by the Department of Environment before with good effect, and we've spoken to the department about this, where you have the normal process, but to relieve pressure in the system, you allow developers to come and say, okay, we'd like to pay extra for this process, and we'd like our process in a month instead of 60 days or whatever it's going to take.
Oh, I don't like that.
You don't like
I
that?
Don't like the rich to have preferences.
Ah, but it's better for the poor as well.
It's not better for the poor.
It is.
The houses that you develop, the poor definitely can live in.
I'll tell you why it's better for the poor developer, at least, or the poor person that's trying to get through the system as well. If you have a fast-track system, which is paid for by the developer, the richer developers, then you give less pressure on the normal system, so the poorer people get their applications heard quicker. Do you see what I'm saying? So it means the developer take pressure off the system.
I mean, it doesn't sound logical to me. All it means is you're creating big scope for corruption in the civil service.
I hope not. I think it would have to be done.
If people are going to be able to pay for their services being not jumping the queue, then there's big scope for corruption.
Well, if it's done in a rational and ordered way, and you as a department, the department has the resources that they use when people come along and ask for this service, so it's extra resources, it's not the same resources that otherwise would be used. So I think the way to do it properly. Let's
move on.
There's
not going to be much support for that one, okay?
Okay. And the method for dealing with stock and flow, so sometimes the department might actually be dealing with applications as quickly as they're coming in, but there's a 3-month waiting list. If you bring in extra resources, clear that 3 months, you may have to do it once, and then the applications no longer have a 3-month waiting list anymore. So it's bringing in management procedures that deal with this kind of thing. And actually putting in institutions, committees, well, not necessarily committees, people, individuals, who, when there's a time limit problem, can come in and sort it out. So that fast track people that you can phone and they'll talk to the department wherever and they'll get the situation sorted out. So make it happen kind of people. As I said, there's people that re-engineer business processes for a living, so they can be very effective in any business, including government business. Remove unnecessary participants from different types of decisions. Sometimes certain types of applications don't need to go to like 10 different departments, they need to go to 3. Working that out and restricting it can also make things move faster. And then there's great times after which it seems that the head of the department doesn't have an opinion if they don't reply within a certain time, because that can be a big cause of delay. And then what some departments do already, bringing people together to make a decision in a weekly meeting, 7 different departments, rather than it circulating from department to department, will make decisions quicker. And talking about petrol stations, one example where standards can be used. In our view, and I believe the department agrees with us on this, EIAs are only when you don't know something. EIAs aren't where there's a particular, it doesn't matter how serious the situation is, you can have a big petrol station, but the danger that petrol stations present to the environment is well known. So you can put in a standard rather than having EIAs every time that tell you exactly the same as what you've done in the last 100 you did. And so we believe, and again we're willing to help, to create standards for different situations so that an EIA isn't necessary and the information is known. It's not to do, we emphasise, about the danger of the thing, it's about the level of knowledge. It could be a small thing, but if the information isn't known, then an EIA is needed. If it is known, then So we suggest that 20 standards a year are created, and if that's too much for the department, which is what he said when we spoke to them, then we can bring in outside resources to do that as well. And not just for, we all think in terms of the green situation for standards, but also for the social situation. When there's a small village in a mining area, this is the social standards to what we're in that situation. So the environment in the wider sense, or the economic environment. We're very happy to see the new EMFs coming in. We'd like to see government being proactive, the departments being proactive, and identify in advance sites that they're going to give approval for. So to actually say, we think this site with this kind of development, if anyone wants to come and apply for it, we'll give it to you, kind of thing. Obviously, there might still be some kind of a process, but maybe a much shorter one. Things like brownfield sites, brownfield sites, that should be areas for infill where you want to create extra density, and what we call outfill, which is where you're moving industry out of the city to where the people are rather than bringing people into the city where the jobs are. So a similar type of thing when you're wanting to create density. And where you can say in this, you don't need any IA in this zone because we've already cleared it environmentally and we know what the situation is. And then, if you remove certain things that don't need the IA, you can then concentrate the limited department resources on significant environmental sensitive areas, things like fracking, things like acid mine drainage, you know, serious well-known problems that people seem to be dealing with. Other small improvements have 15-page summary at the beginning of the EIA. A lot of environmental NGOs say the same thing. We agree, just make things easier. And instead, convert the process. So the things we need is balance.
2 minutes left.
Okay. Balance, speed, and improving the process. And just to comment quickly on some of the things that other people said, we agree very much that developers should keep the promises. So we're in favour of that proposal. However, we have to dig into account where there's been factors beyond their control. Like 2008, there was a global recession, so a lot of things fell apart. It's well not beyond the developer's control. But where there are developers that don't keep their promises, they could be held to them. They should be held to them. We agree with that. How can we not? The only problem with cutting off an application midway when the developer doesn't proceed with it in sufficient time is that it can be the kind of situation whereby there's a factor beyond their control. It can be financing, it can be buyers, it can be a global recession. We wouldn't agree with that. About the independence of EIPs, there have been EIPs, environmental assessment practitioners, prosecuted in law for giving bad advice, and that's certainly a disincentive to them. The All African Parliament situation, where the EIP didn't identify the proper or was too much for the developer and too little for the environment, he was prosecuted and fined, and lost his license as well. So there is a way to deal with that particular situation, and it should happen when that EIP does not act in the way that you should. And that's it. Thanks.
It's a lot of issues you've raised, a lot of it food for thought. And we will do that and make it part of the report. As I said, some of it, I think, may, particularly around the time issues, we may have dealt with now, at least in one form in the legislation. There may be other ways of also dealing with it, so we won't exclude that. And trying to do some of those things. I've already commented on that other issue. Okay, comments, questions? Seem quite clear, it's a whole list of stuff. Mr. Wills, anything from your side? You're happy to look at all those issues for us? Except the one.
Closing the file.
Huh? No, closing the file we want to go ahead on. Because the problem is the applicant, we can't have applications hanging around for 6 months where they've been asked to give us information, they don't give it. So
that's correct. But I do think that there are circumstances and it's really a system design thing. I think you can have a pending and a closing. You could have putting an application into a pending file with notification that closure will take place in such and such a time frame.
No, whatever you do, it doesn't matter. All I'm just thinking, there must be a consequence for non-compliance.
Correct.
There's a moment many people came in and said there's not a single consequence for the applicant not complying with information. And the one that's problematic is the fast-tracking one. Mm. That you guys are going to get paid extra to... That's the one I'm worried about.
Okay.
Thank you very much, and thanks for your time and effort and making yourself available. It's much appreciated. Thanks.
Now it is our three, I imagine it's the three ladies over there that have walked in, Ms. Brownlee, Kutsia, and Morris. Your last, step forward, over here,
okay.
So I can see you, you're in throwing distance. Come, all of you, come and account for your sins. Can't just leave one to carry the whole load. Quickly 10 minutes runs out, and if any issues, we'll then engage with you. Thank you for the time and effort for being here.
Okay, thank you, and thank you very much to the committee for giving us this opportunity. We are last, but I hope not least. And essentially what we're going to do is just highlight a few of the key points that we made in our submission. From our point of departure, we wanted to contextualize what we're saying on the basis of the imperative within the Constitution to look after the environment and to remind ourselves also that within the delivery agreement in respect of environment and outcome 10, there are very clear commitments around environment. And legislation also has clear commitments and clear obligations as far as the environment is concerned, and then specifically sustainable development and how decisions should be made if one takes into account the principles in NEMA. And all of these, essentially, well, what is important for us, recognize that the natural systems are central to human health and well-being and ultimately to our society. Now, what we want to do this afternoon is just to highlight some of the things that we, through the experience that the three of us have, and that experience spans many years, both as people in the private sector, as environmental assessment practitioners, but also having had government experience and as a decision maker. And we've tried to bring all of this together in identifying what we feel how things are not or not going right and what should not be done, and then to end off with some points around how things can be improved and what should be done. And essentially, if we keep in mind what the context was that I've just sketched, what we're saying is that the current focus on project level is something that is creating problems. In the sense that it ignores policy and planning level at the higher level, the more strategic level. We also feel that the continual or frequent amendment of legislation is something that creates confusion and uncertainty within whether it's the development sector or amongst the professionals or even within government. Thirdly, we feel that often what goes wrong is that spatial development planning and environmental planning are dealt with as separate exercises. They're not seen as an integral activity, and invariably the environmental planning doesn't inform development decision making. Fourthly, in decision making one often finds that the central deciding or determining factor tends to be purely economic growth as opposed to growth that is also ecologically sustainable. Another what we find, in our view, feel is something that is goes wrong is where there's an emphasis on minimizing impacts rather than avoiding impacts that could be significantly detrimental to the environment. Another thing that we've seen go wrong is that EIA frequently are quite rigid in their in the way in which they're unfold and are handled, and it has a sort of tick box approach or mentality to it. And people tend to forget why an EIA is being done and what the ultimate goal is. Often, and this is quite an important one also, is that the environmental or the natural systems are not taken into account in decision making. And what we're saying here is that the long-term costs of having clean air and making sure that the air is clean or biodiversity is protected and clean water and having that available in good quantity for future generations is not taken into account. And that would affect people's quality of life. Something that we also have problems with is that environmental decision-making is often or where it is made by other authorities that have a different mandate. It's a mandate that is maybe geared toward exploiting a resource as opposed to protecting resources. And finally, the decision-making processes are often uncoordinated and not based upon common sustainability objectives. And in many cases, and we've done quite a lot of reviews on EIAs of large projects, and we find that often the NEMA principles have not been taken into account in making decisions, and invariably the net result of that is that there could not have been and there isn't recognition given to the constitutional imperative vis-a-vis sustainable development. Now, in taking it forward, what we're essentially saying is that both at the level of looking at how policy or the approach or the system should be developed forward, but also at the level of each individual EIA, I think it's necessary to sort of go back to a couple of basics and to say to oneself, what is the issue or the problem that one is dealing with? And once you have a clear understanding and agreement around that is to identify why it is an issue. And then from that is to move forward and to say, okay, how does one deal with this? What is the outcome that we're wanting to achieve? What is the desired end state that we're wanting to achieve? Because we find or we feel that very often people are having, they have different views about these things and people have different objectives and the end result is then different. So what we're presenting this afternoon in terms of what we think can be done to improve the situation and to ensure that the constitutional imperative is met, that the environmental rights are satisfied, that the principles of NEMA are taken into account and that one does end up with a situation of development that is sustainable. At the level of law and policy, I think the most obvious thing clearly is to reduce the fragmentation and to ensure alignment and integration within the legislation and the regulatory framework. The second thing that is very important is that the EIA as an instrument, a tool, needs to be a sustainability-led process. And the important thing there is that one must measure development against sustainable objectives, that one needs to identify which are the impacts that would result in the irrevocable degradation or loss of resources, the natural and the social resources.
I mean, what you say, I agree with, but how do you propose one does it? That your EIA becomes sustainably, relevantly driven? Well, I mean, your problem with your EIAs is your EAPs are not necessarily experts that are independent and do things for themselves. So only they can drive the sustainability part. So you're expecting them then to be the experts to make decisions on sustainability. That's why I'm asking the question. I can't disagree with what you're saying, but how practice will one do that?
Okay. I'm going to ask Tuti to pop in here as well. But I think I think that is an excellent point. I think what we need to do is we have a set of NEMA principles which essentially provide a springboard, as I see it, or as we see it, for developing firm sustainability criteria, which then become
something that the EIA practitioner has to demonstrate how that project is going to satisfy those particular sustainability criteria. At the moment, we're doing things kind of from the bottom up. We're saying, this is what I want to do, these are going to be the impacts, this is how significant they're going to be, and now it's over to the decision maker. And what we'd like to see is something that rather says, this is my project, this is what I have to achieve through this project. How am I going to do it for water, for people, for biodiversity, for whatever, health, equity, etc. So turn the process on its head, rather. And that has been done in some countries. I think Canada is one shining example where they tried to do that. The Netherlands as well. MJ, I don't know if you want to...
Well, I think added to what Susie's saying, legislation requires you to report against certain criteria, such as the nature of the impact, the extent of the impact, the duration of the impact, which is somewhat different to saying, does this project meet a particular environmental or sustainability objective? And so what happens is that people do a baseline environmental analysis of what's there, they superimpose the project on it, and they say, well, this is the impact. And 9 times out of 10, the impacts are actually underestimated because factors such as irreplaceability of resources, whether the impacts are irreversible or not, even the extent to which the impact can be resolved are not adequately dealt with. So I think that it would help if there was some obligation placed on practitioners in the legislation to be assessing projects against criteria drawn from the NEMA principles and not these very limited criteria that we currently have.
Okay. You go ahead.
Thanks. I think the other thing that is important is that one needs to identify in a very pragmatic way how the sort of remaining or the residual negative impacts are going to be compensated. And there are various tools that one can use for that. And then one needs to also identify within the process in very clear terms who or what stands to gain from the particular development and what are those the sort of the internal costs of that development and how is that benefit, where does that benefit lie. These are things that are often dealt with at a fairly superficial level in EIA. At the level of policy and strategic and spatial planning, the thing that needs to happen there is to focus it more on sustainability objectives in the development of the, whether the policy or the spatial planning tool, and to integrate the environmental considerations into the formulation of the plan and the process from the outset, rather than make it an add-on or an afterthought or not to consider it at all. With respect to decision-making, the key is to ensure alignment and coordination between decision-makers, and there is a certain amount of work that has been done and certain achievements that have been made in that respect. But there is still quite a lot that can be done, and we feel something that needs to be looked at more is the whole concept of trade-offs and how these can be used and when it would be appropriate. I think the important thing there is to understand that they should be as a last resort rather than the first resort, but they are tools that could be used. There needs to be something which we feel quite strongly on is that with regard to making decisions about whether to authorize or not, there needs to be a clear obligation or provision that allows the decision maker to refute an application which will not achieve sustainability. There is a similar provision in the Integrated Coastal Management Act which allows this. And I think that the reason why we say that is important is because it makes it clear to everybody from the outset that if your proposal or your development is not going to meet certain sustainability criteria, then it's a no-go. It's not going to happen. And then lastly, I think we've talked about this issue about formalizing the criteria within the NEMA principles. And then just applying those policy and planning tools in decision making. These are tools that are or products that are often developed at great cost and they take quite a long time to develop, and then invariably they land in file 13 and decisions are made without clear consideration of the spatial, the environmental framework planning tool. And that's basically all we have to say. Thank you.
Any of you want to add something? Feel free. Anything to add? Yes, ma'am.
To add one point which we did have, I think with respect, it's very difficult to pull out a couple of points from quite a verbose submission, a written submission. But one thing I really would like to emphasize, I think at the moment, at a policy level and a plan level, our sense is that environmental costs or externalities, if for the economists in the room, are not being adequately addressed in the formulation or the conceiving of policy and plans. And increasingly so, I think we're facing a natural capital crunch in a country. And if we are serious about trying to plan for sustainable futures or sustainable development, it's going to become increasingly important to bring in the environmental costs, these external externalities, not only at project level, but at plan, program, and policy level. I'd really like to just make a plea for that, because at the moment we really are stuck at project level.
Now, and unfortunately, when you hear, I mean, the property people that were here earlier, I mean, of course, they think it's completely the other way. They're saying that we've bent the stick completely towards the environment, and I'm sitting here shaking my head. I mean, because if you go and look at the State of the Environment report, you can see that the stick is only going one way, and that's away from the environment, not towards the environment. So it's just, again, you know, we were saying yesterday in the committee is that we need a real debate around this in the country. That people should understand is, I mean, to me, when I hear, and I quickly listen to people, you can see where they fit into this. There's those that believe the environment fits into the economy. And then those, like this committee, that believes the other way around, that the economy fits into the environment, and it has to fit nicely, else you need to compromise and so on. And the problem is we haven't had that debate, because you won't find a single person. I've never found anyone that will say, no, the environment is not important. But when they actually start talking what they mean by it, like the property developers would then come up and say, no, you can't bend the stick so far towards the environment. It is because we've not had that debate and we don't have the, one understanding of this issue, is that sustainable development is the principle that drives everything in our constitution, and that you must give effect to that and must give meaning to it. And if you do, then it's not a question of stopping development, but development has to fit into that paradigm, else it's not worthwhile development. It's just, the cost is just big, otherwise down the line. And of course, it's not an easy debate to have, because, I mean, people don't have that perspective. So it's a real difficulty I find more and more when I sit here to see us trying to tinker with these issues when the bigger issue hasn't been sorted, and that is in our heads. We haven't sorted up the debate about what this means. Because as I say to you, I won't find a single person in my party. I wouldn't say, oh no, the environment is very important. But when I listen to them talking, I quickly say, no, but for you, the environment is actually just a nice add-on. For those people, you know, the environment is clearly central to the issue, and that is how you're going to attain sustainable development is look after your environment. So I think, I don't know what to do about it, because it's a debate that we need to start. And clearly the politicians need involvedness to get this debate, and civil society needs to be involved, so that we can start getting to a place where we know what we mean by sustainable development. Because, you know, people can't see the cumulative effect. They look at their little project and they'll say, but why, how will I affect sustainable development with this little housing project of mine? It's going to obliterate the whole mountain and you can't see the mountain anymore, and there's just going to be buildings. But how does that affect anything, you know? So yeah, it's an interesting issue. It's one that I think we need a lot of work to on. I think most of the things you say, I mean, we as a committee agreed. It's an issue of trying to get things more practicalized. And, I would love us to be able to move more towards driving the processes to agree issues on the basis of sustainability. But if you look at the weaknesses in the system, to get from where we are to get there, you're almost going to have to go through a whole education process of people that do EAPs to get them to be able to do that. Because we can only do it if their quality of work is good. So it's, again, that's another issue. So yeah, all your points I think are taken. We'll make it part of the report and deal with it.
Any last issues you want to raise or respond to? Any of you? Anything else? Yes, of course.
Sorry, chatting too much. Your point about the EAP, I think one of the, you know, I am an EAP. And feedback from fellow EAPs, I think over the years, we have moved from one where the emphasis has been on trying to innovate, trying to be creative in doing our impact assessment work. And in the last 10 years, I think it's fair to say, and I'm sure my colleagues would agree, that there's a sense of disillusionment with impact assessment. It's become something that you just have to see, okay, the law asked me to do that, yes, I have to answer this question, I have to provide this information. And in a way, as Eng said, people have lost why we're doing it. So it's, and perhaps in a perverse way, if one wants to say, well, okay, let's go back to refocusing on why we're actually doing it. Many of those EAPs would relish the opportunity to come up with new and different and innovative and better ways of doing impact assessment at whatever level.
No, we must try and do that and keep on improving. And as I say, this IPASA is on the process of being formed. So hopefully we'll regularize something there and see what we can do. So let's hope all those things work, ma'am.
Just another thought in terms of the legislation. It's quite loose in terms of the relationship between spatial planning and environmental planning. And we've got this instrument now, environmental management framework. But there's no obligation on the planning authorities to take account of the EMF. And so you potentially end up in a situation where the spatial plan and the environmental plan are in conflict with one another. And ultimately, the way that might play itself out is your planning authority might say yes to a development and your environmental authority might say no, which ultimately comes to a no. We've done some work on EMF projects, and the point that we've tried to put across to the municipalities and other authorities that we've worked with is that one of the things we've got to do in the plan is look at the environmental attributes and the condition as best we can on basing information of those attributes. And one can see that the environment is under stress. And so we need to respond to that in an innovative way. So we're not saying no to development. We're saying when you plan development, you know about these stresses and strains in the environment, so plan your development in a way that responds to that, as opposed to expecting the environment to always give way.
I think those are the, you know, and I have said to Mr. Wilsnem that they need to look at these issues. And this one of, which I regard as the biggest obstacle in government, is the coordination of the fragmentation. I mean, both in terms of departmentally, but also in the levels of government. And we have tried to introduce some clauses in the new legislation to try and deal with some of those issues. That is really the big challenge, and we are pushing the department to try and sit down with the other department and sign MOUs and so on to say this is how we're going to do it. With the mining now, we've got them to sit down, they've got an agreement to say this is how we're going to synchronize. We first do this, then this, and this, and this. So that is one of those aspects that we're trying to look at, and then we've asked Mr. Wilden to look at some of the others to try and deal with some of these. But can I thank you very much for making yourself available and coming share your experience and experiences with us. It's much appreciated. Thank you. Okay, so that is the end of two long days, which I think have been very fruitful and useful. Obviously, I personally, not being long in this area, have learned an enormous amount, and I imagine some of you have as well. I do want to take up the suggestion to make some space for the department to come and go through these processes with us more fully, so that we can more fully understand the processes, of course the object of this was for the department to hear all this, for us to hear it, and they are now going to draft a report for us, and in that report it's going to be a little bit unusual in the sense that it's not just going to be a report of what people said, but they're also going to try and respond to some of it for us, in the sense of saying, okay, well, you know, people have raised that this thing has become more sustainability driven. Now, some of the options here are this and this and this, and these are some of the challenges. So we're going to have a more kind of interactive report from the department. And then maybe we can engage more on this. Hopefully, I mean, we're not around for long anymore, so the next committee, hopefully this can be some of our legacy we pass on to them. But we will try and do some of that. Now, have we got a copy of the program? Now, we adjourn now, and as I said, our meetings for next week have been cancelled, so we now will come back on Tuesday the 13th, and we won't have Dia on that, no, 13th. We won't have Dia, we'll have water.